Thanks for listening to the Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
Fake football last night. Ravens 17, Bears 16. I don't think the score means that much to you. We saw Lamar Jackson in the second half of that game. Well, you know what? That's a good... You know, last night I'm sitting there trying to get involved in this game before going to sleep. And I'm thinking to myself, if there was ever a time where it would definitely behoove the entertainment value of something like this to gamble, this is a perfect example. Like, I was going to clown it, and then I thought about it, and I was just like, man... If I were betting on a bunch of random things in this game, I definitely would be more entertained with what's going on because especially the first half was just kind of, well, the whole game was kind of dull. I was impressed a little bit with RG3. I was interested to see him. I'm glad we didn't have to watch Flacco because honestly, I don't care. RG3, there's a little bit of intrigue there, and certainly Lamar Jackson's a rookie. That in the preseason, I think for the most part, Jeff, is what people watch. They watch for the rookie quarterbacks and a couple of other skill position players. They know, like, this year we're going to watch all these quarterbacks and be very interested to see that. And Saquon Barkley, I would say we're going to be interested to watch him, and maybe just a couple other guys that I can't even think of who they are right now. But generally, that's what the mass people are watching. Like, you're going to watch the linemen, and there are going to be people that are going to watch the entire field for certain reasons. But in general, we're watching the glitz positions.
Oh, of course we are, because that's what everyone, you know, wants to see. They want to see the high players drafted, the quarterbacks drafted. I mean, it's hard to judge last night offensive line play. No one's watching for the third string left tackle. Yeah. We're watching for Lamar Jackson, RG3. Trubisky didn't play last night. I'm sure, I don't even know what the national TV schedule is for preseason games in week one, but you're looking for all the young quarterbacks, the young running backs, and even like defensive players. It's really hard to judge, you know, a defense like a Bradley Chubb for the Broncos, for example, unless he just gets a sack all the time in the preseason, right? It's hard to really watch him the entire time. I'm trying to see if which games are like on national TV for like Browns Giants is on NFL Network in the first week of the preseason. Oh, of course, right? Saquon Barkley will play play a drive. Cowboys Niners. No surprise there. It's two teams, you know, that are fairly popular. And then you have Falcons Jets. So Sam Darnold is going to be on national TV. Lions Raiders, John Gruden on national TV. Broncos Vikings on national TV. So like you have all these teams.
Cousins
and Keenum as well.
Keenum,
but they're only going to play a drive each, which is so ridiculous. That's on national TV, and that's why we're watching for literally one drive a game, but it's the preseason. And look, I tell you, man, I love football. I watched the entire game last night because I had the over and I had the Ravens. It's really funny. So at the end of, I got the number early, so I pushed on the over. But, you know, the Ravens get the ball at the 9-yard line with about 2 minutes left, and everyone on Twitter is like, run the football! Because no one takes the under in a preseason game. If they would have run the ball three times, they might have scored. And then, I would have covered with the Ravens, and I would have hit the over, too. So it was funny to see how many people really gambled on this game last night. There were quite a few.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, I think if you had action last night, that would have made it more interesting past the obvious, just watching Lamar Jackson go 4-for-10 for 33 yards, did have a touchdown, did have an interception where the guy jumped on the route. You saw some of that athleticism, to be sure, where he was trying to escape. You also saw how much faster guys in the NFL are, even the guys that he was playing against, which is not going to be what he's going to see if he's out there on the field during the regular season. But you saw flashes of the kinds of things that make him such an enticing just athlete, somebody that you want to try and put the football in that guy's hands and see what he can do with it. But you also saw this is definitely a project as it pertains to him being a quarterback in this league. I mean, he wasn't ready to play last night. Not that I think anyone should have been expecting him to, but I honestly think it's probably best for him that he didn't go out there and just wow the world in that situation, because we live in a very hyperbolic society, especially on social media when it comes to the extremes. I think you saw some good from Lamar Jackson last night, and you saw some things that you would rather not have seen from his play on the field. But but this is a growth process for a very young football player, potentially with a very bright future. And I think that being measured in response is the key here for everybody that is objective or trying to pay attention to this in a real way.
It is. And, I think if we look at him, the one telling throw he made last night was the interception, where it was just as simple as can be, hitch route. The ball fluttered. It was thrown on the wrong shoulder. It was very as simple as can be, right? I mean, he predetermined he was throwing that ball, which was, I think, the right place to throw it anyways. And that's the type of throw that, and look, he's not going to be under center that often. So, I mean, that was under center play action pass a little bit, draw pass. But nonetheless, like those are the type of throws where you're like, you can't have those. And I think that's what everyone talks about as far as, not just, you can't do that. You have to be better than that. And that's, a bunch of that is, accuracy issues that we've talked about with Lamar Jackson.
Yeah. But, we're going to see it. We're going to see plenty of blemishes from all these quarterbacks. It is going to be fun to watch them play. You made the point earlier, Jeff, and I think it is very true. Like, you watched the game last night, and then you're like, how many games are going to be played tonight? Like, who are we going to get to see today? The answer is no one. We're not going to get to see anybody for like a week, which is a little bit sad. Little bit sad, to be sure. Not sad. Look, people were actually coming. I'm not a big Phil Mickelson fan. I never have been, because I've always been a Tiger guy, and I feel like, in many respects, if you're a Tiger guy, you're anti-Phil. Maybe not everybody, but I've always kind of seen Phil as somewhat disingenuous and more Shooter McGavin than anything else. And I've read a lot of reports through the years of golfers that encounter him, in a clubhouse when it's just, the guys in there, and he's very standoffish and not the guy that you see when the camera is on him. But good move by him, and good move by this dress shirt company that put together this ad yesterday, Mizzen and Maine. It nearly broke Twitter in a very interesting way. Some people were just like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. Right, that was the point. Like, you missed the point if that's a problem. Yes. I thought this thing was hilarious. I enjoyed it tremendously. Now, Phil Mickelson in this ad proves something that I'm not sure we've ever given him enough credit for, and that is that he has very creepy eyes.
I did not
like
look
if you
at
go
eyes.
Back and watch this thing and pay attention to the way he stares at the camera, it's a problem. But the whole way that this was done, I mean, it's a 37-second ad, but it just, there's no way to watch that and not laugh at it. Like, that to me is the kind of athlete that you want, the one that's not afraid to laugh at himself. But that was very, very well done, in my opinion. I enjoyed that tremendously yesterday.
Oh, it was extremely well done. It was fabulous, I thought. They did a good job of making it viral. That was the point of that. It was to be viral, for us to be talking about it on the radio, and to laugh and joke about the t-shirt, the dress shirt. It was as corny as can be. It was exactly what I imagined a commercial could be with Phil. It was fantastic, I thought.
It was. Did you guys see that out in L.A.? Danny, we haven't brought you in today. Roberto, Eddie Garcia, if you're near a microphone. I enjoyed this a lot. Did you guys dig this?
No, we've been paying attention to baseball here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, exactly. Stop talking about the Dodgers. Nobody cares about your 21 runs.
The Dodgers scored 3 touchdowns last night. So
yeah, it's still not the most that was scored in baseball this week by a team.
That's true.
That was the Washington Nationals.
It was very Nationals of them last night. How about this, though? So I go to Chavez Ravine on Tuesday. The Dodgers get 2 hits. I walk out of the stadium kicking rocks. And then another close friend of mine is at the game last night and laughing at me, texting me the entire time because it was, riches beyond riches. Can you imagine watching 21 runs being scored? And that poor position player for the Brewers who came in, Hernan Perez, third baseman for the Brewers. This is his second mop-up appearance in 2 weeks against the Dodgers. First one in Milwaukee, and then last night the Dodgers had, a 9-run inning against them? And in the first appearance, he hit a Dodger batter with a 48-mile-per-hour fastball. I'm thinking Jeff can throw a faster fastball.
How far? How hard?
48 miles per hour.
I can throw faster than that.
Yeah, I mean, remember when Jose Reyes hit someone the other day? It was through 53-mile-an-hour fastball.
I think most of our listeners can throw faster than 48 miles per hour.
I'd probably get in at least the high 60s, low 70s.
All right, so I know we have Morosi coming up to talk a little bit of baseball. So some quick MLB trivia for you guys. Last night's 21 runs for the Dodgers was a stadium record. How many years have the Dodgers been playing there at Chavez Ravine? Jeff should know this, but 50, Jeff is a Giants 50, fan for some reason.
I would say
reason.
60, 61.
Oh, the they played in the Coliseum for a couple of years when they first got to L.A. I think Jason's right. Probably like 62, 63.
You guys aren't that far off. 56 years. The first game at Dodger Stadium was April 10th, 1962.
18 hits for the Dodgers last night, 21-5.
Dodgers hit for the cycle with home runs. They had a one-run, two-run, and three-run homer, plus the grand slam from Bellinger, who snapped out of his shoulder.
What's crazy, when you watch the 30-for-30 on Valenzuela, like, I didn't realize the backstory for how Chavez Ravine was made.
Oh, yeah, how they had to boot out tons of residents,
Like, you would think, and I grew up there, obviously, like, you go to the stadium all the time, you're like, oh, this is beautiful land, I'm sure no one had developed before. No, there were entire communities there, and they just bulldozed them down and moved the families, like, with force to make the stadium. It's like, oh, wow, okay, I feel a little different about the stadium now.
They did give them nice payouts, but people just didn't want to leave their homes,
obviously. No, they forcefully removed people. They didn't want to leave. Now, of course, they gave them payouts and they bought them houses and stuff, but still, like, they still bulldozed their houses while they were in protest of leaving.
And there is a school underneath Dodger Stadium buried.
No way.
Yeah.
18 hits last night for the Dodgers. They weren't the only ones offensive last night. Baseball was offensive last night in general. 21 runs for the Dodgers on 18 hits. The Rangers, 17 runs on 18 hits. The Red Sox, 15 runs on 19 hits. The Nationals, 10 runs on 10 hits. That's a lot of double-figure output games by single Major League Baseball teams last night.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
John Morosi, he's on Twitter at J-O-N Morosi on Twitter. John, good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Jason and Jeff, good morning to you. And how about, as you say, the Clayton Kershaw anthem coming back in? That's his song at Dodger Stadium and a nice, tidy 21-5 triumph for Kershaw and the Dodgers there last night at Chavez Ravine.
Yeah, nice and tidy. Let's start there then. Let's talk about the Dodgers. The Dodgers made themselves better. It seems like they did everything they could at the trade deadline to find ways to improve that roster for the stretch run. They get Axford. They get Brian Dozier. They already land Manny Machado. You can't say the Dodgers aren't trying, right, John?
Well, I agree, and this is a season in which they're going for it in a way that I can't really recall similarly investing in prospects, let's say, in multiple deals and in a collection of deals, at least under the current front office. Last year, of course, they acquired Yu Darvish, but I think this is a greater investment in prospects to land Manny Machado and Brian Dozier and add John Axford to the bullpen. You could argue, and maybe they will find a way to make one more bullpen addition before August is done when you can make trades using waivers. But in general, they've got now a new number two hitter right now at the moment in Manny Machado, and then, of course, bumps Justin Turner down to the three spot. Now that Turner is back, Brian Dozier batted sixth last night, went 2-for-5 with four RBI. So it's funny because Dozier was linked to the Dodgers at great length two off seasons ago, but the deal never happened. And now he's with LA, and it looks as though he should have been here all along because he really has a great approach to the plate, a big-time power bat for a second baseman. And you can really tell, Jason, that much like Manny Machado, he is relishing the chance to be in a pennant race after spending the first half with a struggling team.
So this is a question I know Clay asks you a lot, and every time we have you on, it seems like we have to ask a few questions because some narratives will not go away. This one, though, this Red Sox team, 76 wins, this roster, this pitching staff, which they added a little bit of depth to right there at the trade deadline. They also bring in Ian Kinsler. How good is this team? Like, this team might be better than the teams that have won the World Series. Like, it's amazing how good this Red Sox team appears to be.
Well, that's a very good point to talk about history, because this is exactly what we're looking at. We are looking at a historically great Red Sox team. First of all, you see a game last night in which they beat the Yankees by a touchdown, and they have Steve Pierce as their hero with a three-homer game. And he is not somebody that we always talk about as being one of the more dominant players on the team, and yet he was brought in because he has a lot of success against the lefty arms in this division, and that's exactly what happened last night with a three-homer game. By the way, Steve Pierce, in addition to hitting three home runs, he has already hit for the AL East cycle. He has played for every single team in the American League East, all five of them. And as you point out, the history of the Red Sox, at the moment, they are tied with the 1912 Red Sox for the best winning percentage in a single season in Red Sox history. That's how good they are. So, by the numbers, this is not even any sort of subjective statement. Objectively, this is tied for the best Red Sox team ever. And even if they were to fall back a little bit of the 1912 Red Sox, they're still better than the 46 Red Sox who made it to the World Series and lost. I mean, this is a historically great Red Sox team. This earlier this century, the only other one that was close, the 04 Red Sox, they had a winning percentage of .605. The current winning Red Sox winning percentage is .691. That's how great they are right now, and they seem to be getting better.
You just mentioned the Red Sox scoring a lot of runs. Dodgers had 21 last night. I believe the Rangers also had like 15 or 16. The Nationals had 25 three nights ago. We've seen a really uptick in runs, especially since the All-Star break. Is offense going to be this dominant, you think, heading down the stretch?
I do. I think that we're, of course, Jeff, in a pretty strong offensive time for the game in general. And there's still a lot of questioning about the trends in general and what MLB may be able to do to help mitigate at least some of the strikeouts. That's more of the concern than the runs scored on their own. But I think what we are seeing probably with some of the trade deadline maneuvering, more of a collection of talent on the teams that are truly going for it, because there are fewer of them this year than there usually are. So it's more of a select group of contenders, at least in the American League, where we've basically got six teams competing for five spots. So as more and more of the talent gets concentrated on those select rosters, it stands to reason that we'll see even more maybe lopsided games here and there. The average team, though, is scoring 4.47 runs per game here in the Major League this year. We talk so much, again, about the overall league trends. That's actually a little bit down from last year. Last year was 4.65, but those numbers, as you point out, Jeff, they can sometimes climb during the course of the second half, so maybe we'll see that number get back up a little bit more towards where it was in 2017.
Feels like two stories that came out of MLB trade deadline were two teams that didn't do much as far as selling, and that's the Nationals with Harper and the Mets with some of their young arms. Should both those teams have moved their big-time players?
The Mets, I think, yes. They are clearly entering a rebuilding phase, and they're also doing so at a time when a couple teams in their division, the Braves and the Phillies, are both younger and better than they are. And when you've got your competition is both younger and better than you, it usually means you should reevaluate where you're at, because you're not as good as they are today, and you're not on pace to be as good as they are tomorrow. To me, that was a missed opportunity to move DeGrom, because the Mets had one of the most coveted pitchers in the entire trade market at a time when there really were a lot of teams that wanted pitching, and when there were teams that, for whatever reason, didn't really have the pitching available that was in demand. So I think that was a missed opportunity there. The Nationals, though, interestingly, they've won three straight since the deadline. There were a couple fairly substantial departures. They traded Brandon Kinsler, and the Washington Post reported that part of the reason why is they believe Kinsler was the source for some information about the Nationals' clubhouse problems, and Sean Kelly threw his glove on the mound, and the next day he was gone. So whether that's too little too late, I suppose we will see in due time, but the Nationals making a couple pretty strong statements about where they believe their clubhouse culture needs to go, and so far, so good, at least this week.
John Morosi, our guest here on Outkick the Coverage. I'm a Braves fan, so I want you to talk about Gausman and tell me what kind of move that was for Atlanta. Seems very optimistic if he can live up to the potential that maybe he hasn't so far, but he seems to have the talent. But when you look at that division as a whole, let's stay with the Nationals. I think they have the second highest payroll in baseball. They have not been able to do what people expected them to be able to do, and largely most of it centers around Bryce Harper. I mean, there's obviously other issues, but Bryce Harper in general, he had one absolutely terrific season. And then when you look at the rest of his career, the numbers are relatively average. Is it possible that most people that aren't paying close attention to baseball may have overvalued Bryce Harper based on his name and that maybe he's just a little bit overrated, or is he just going through a tough stretch right now?
Well, that's a great question, and I would even describe it as a $300 million question, because that's the numbers and the projection that was put out there for Harper as a free agent this wintertime. That's what literally every front office in baseball is trying to mull over right now. Perhaps it's somewhere in the middle. I think he may not quite be as continually and enduringly great as he was during his MVP year, and he's probably better than he's showing right now. I think it's somewhere probably in the middle. But the question there is, if he's a 900 OPS player, we have seen a number of 900 OPS players come up and become free agents here in recent years, and they, by and large, have not had contracts like the ones that are being projected and forecasted for Harper. So I think Machado has surpassed Harper as being the marquee free agent this winter. I think Manny, based on positional value and the season he's having right now, is the overall better free agent now than Harper is. Harper still obviously has a lot of attributes and can still be a great player, I believe, but right now the numbers don't say it. So I think his persona has always been immense in the game, and perhaps there have been years in which, like this one, that he's talked about more than his numbers suggest he should be. He's still a very above-average player. He's still somebody that's a young free agent, which front offices care about. So I think that the hype for most of his career has been warranted, but he has picked a very inopportune year to have one of his worst seasons and really call into question a lot of what his value is going to be going forward. He really does not, Jason, make a lot of adjustments at the plate. That's my big concern. I love, if I'm going to spend this level of money on a player, I want him to be able to adjust out of his own slumps and adapt on the fly and be a very, I think, changeable hitter when circumstances warrant. He has an approach. He stays with that approach. When a pitcher's repertoire lines up with that approach, he can hit the ball a long way. But when a pitcher knows how to pitch him and avoid the danger zones, Bryce Harper this year has been, at times, far too easy to strike out.
Okay, so he's kind of robotic in that way. You know what he's going to do. His tendencies aren't going to change. Just since you mentioned that, give us some examples maybe over the last handful of years of guys that are the opposite of that. Like when you watch them, you know they're going to find a way, that they're going to do whatever it takes to get past that pitcher. They're not just going to stand there and do the exact same thing.
Well, I think Mike Trout has changed as time has gone on, and Trout remains, I think, in this game, the gold standard of an adaptable hitter. There was the talk that he had a hole in his swing, or at least in an area where that he couldn't really get to as well. Basically, up and out over the middle of the plate, oddly enough. But he's shown he can hit that pitch better now than he was in the past. I like, maybe just because Jason, I'm a short guy. I like these hitters who are not that big in stature, but have just incredible coordination and can cover really all aspects of the zone. Mookie Betts, Jose Altuve, Jose Ramirez, Francisco Lindor. These are hitters that are harder, at least in the modern times, to strike out than Harper has been. And I think especially Ramirez and Lindor, and even I look at Michael Brantley in Cleveland, those are the players, and we saw this with Houston last year, Alex Bregman. Altuve was certainly another example. Correa at different times during the World Series. George Springer, even George had his struggles, but he was able to come out of it. At the end of the day, we look at baseball and we celebrate team success above all else. And Harper's team has still not managed to advance out of the division series in four different attempts. And the Astros last year won the World Series because they were able to put the ball in play in key situations. And I believe Jose Altuve represents that ethic as much as anybody else. Although, of course, now for the very first time, he's actually on the disabled list.
Let's take the AL East out of this next question. We all know that everyone loves to watch the Yankees and Red Sox battle to see who's going to win that division. What other division, mostly in the NL, I would say, are you looking forward to watching down the stretch?
I think the East, just because the question is going to come of the staying power with this particular collection of young teams at the top, and the Braves and the Phillies, and the Nationals have this existential clock regarding Harper's free agency that is lingering over them right now. And that, to me, makes that very compelling baseball theater. I look at, the Central's a great division as well, and even the West, with the way the Dodgers have played, and you've got the Diamondbacks and the Rockies still very much involved. But to me, it's the East, because if the Nationals cannot find a way to make the playoffs with this particular cast, you wonder, where do they go from here? Do they lose Harper? Do they find a way to re-sign him because his value is down? I just think that the long-term ramifications in the National League East are more profound than what we're seeing anywhere else. Although in the Central, I still think, looking at this team, that the Brewers should have, for the second straight year, added a major starting pitcher, and they did not. And that worries me. If I'm them, I look at the way they compare to the Cubs. The Cubs have more experience. They just added Cole Hamels. So the Cubs have now gotten even better and even more experience. They, of course, add the World Series MVP from 10 years ago and Cole Hamels. And so I think the Central is interesting as well because of that dynamic with the newcomers, the Brewers, and then, of course, the gold standard and the Cubs. But I think overall the National League East is one that I'm watching most closely.
John, you're the best. Have yourself a good weekend. Avoid chicken. I hear it's a nervous bird.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, as always, guys.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I'm just glad I was there.
Boys and girls.
I thought he thought I was like this ginormous piece of chicken.
Dying time's here.
I had a boa constrictor stuck to my face.
Ma'am, you have a what?
This is Animal Thunderdome.
Danny G, I know you got a couple of stories for us. Take it away.
Yes, sir. File this one under Cowboys do not get enough credit. This from the Buffalo News. Unfortunately, a bull killed a 72-year-old cowboy. A Perry man died yesterday after he was struck by a bull at a farm in the town of Covington, state police say. The victim identified as Roy C. Bell. Police say he was moving cattle from a farm when a one-year-old bull rammed him, charged at him, and killed him at about 11:40 a.m. State police said life-saving measures were administered to Bell, but he was unresponsive. Unfortunately, he died at the scene. So this bull did not want to be moved.
Did it do it because it didn't want to be moved, or did it do it while the cows were being moved? It's almost like it was trying to defend its boys. Like, I don't know if bull was friends with the cattle or what.
This story doesn't clear that up. It says that his body's taken to Monroe County Medical Examiner's office for an autopsy because they're trying to get to the bottom of it.
Was it his bull?
It seems that way in the story, yeah.
That's unfortunate.
Definitely not easy working on a farm.
I've never thought it was easy working on a farm. It's why I have no desire to do so.
Yeah.
Some people want farms, though, because, it's relaxing, all that property and... But obviously a ton of hard work and
dangerous.
Yeah,
but a lot of property means you're doing a lot.
That's true.
Like, it's not like you're on an estate.
Yeah,
or
you're right.
Like
some
that.
People don't even want a backyard or a front yard because they think it's too much work.
I mean, Clay wants a compound, but he doesn't want to actually have to do anything.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right, and sharks, always popular on Animal Thunderdome.
Indeed.
Yes, sharks.
Great white shark attacks a seal off of the coast of Massachusetts as surfers scramble to shore. Right in the middle of about 30 surfers, an estimated 15-foot great white shark attacked a seal in Cape Cod last weekend. A video posted by Ken Martin of Boston shows the moments just after the shark attacked the seal. Lifeguards can be seen ushering the last few surfers inland, while a separate video posted by Martin shows the bloody carcass of a seal floating in the water.
Ooh.
Ugh. Scary there. The shark allegedly took out the seal right in the middle of about 30 surfers. So they had to scramble, get them all to shore. They've seen sharks in this cove following other sea life, so not a good place to surf, it sounds like.
Wow.
You're just watching everyone surf, and all of a sudden there's a bloody carcass floating in the middle of the water, and you see a shark fin.
There are some animals you can look at and say, you know what, I think these are better in pictures. Like, I don't know that I need to be, like, rolled up right on them. And speaking of pictures, California woman checks her home security camera 2 days ago after hearing strange sounds. Around 12:30 a.m., her son told her he heard strange noises outside their home. She didn't give it too much thought. The boy said, Mom, I hear noises. They shrugged it off. She said, you're going to hear noises. There are animals. That's what she told the local television station in California. So she goes and checks her security camera footage the next morning. Discovers that the sounds had come from not one, but two mountain lions that walked up to her front door as if they were trying to sell her something. Just stood next to each other at the front door. Not one, but two mountain lions outside her house. Hung around for 15 minutes, motion detector lights and sounds came on, and the mountain lions did not flinch. So these cougars were going to try and get into this house. So yeah, maybe you should pay attention when your son says you hear noises outside. I'm not saying the mountain lions were going to be able to get into the house, but if you had to take out the garbage, that would not have worked out well.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.